From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we compare last night's presidential debate to the high points and low points in the 40-year history of the televised debates. We talk with Alan Schroeder, author of the new book, Presidential Debates. We'll examine some of the current and past controversies, from debate format and the exclusion of third-party candidates to podium height and camera angles. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new CD from saxophonist Branford Marsalis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. A preliminary agreement has been reached to withdraw Israeli military personnel and armaments now on the West Bank and Gaza Strip, according to Israeli sources. Israeli officials say talks in Paris between Israel's Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat have borne fruit in the effort to stop nearly a week of violence in the area. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat wants an international inquiry into the violence. He accuses Israel of employing excessive force. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports from Israel on the continuing clashes.
Again Wednesday in the Gaza Strip, Israeli helicopter gunships shot rockets at protesters. Witnesses say four helicopters swooped in after Palestinians had opened fire on an Israeli army outpost. At least one Palestinian boy, a 9-year-old, is reported killed, the latest in a series of child victims. What's more, medical workers say among the injured, most have been shot in the upper body. Some charge Israelis with ordering a shoot-to-kill policy. Several international human rights groups have sent teams to investigate. Israeli army spokesmen deny excessive force. They insist they've only responded to fire. And spokesmen criticize Palestinian officials for encouraging children to put themselves at risk. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The Yugoslav Constitutional Court has cast doubt on the legitimacy of that country's presidential election. The opposition claims President Slobodan Milosevic was defeated. NPR's Anne Garrels reports.
The court has annulled parts of the presidential election, but it's not clear if the court's decision requires a recount or completely new elections. Those would be held at an undetermined date, giving President Milosevic more time to maneuver. Following the decision of the court, which is yet to be clarified, the opposition said it will not take part in a second round this Sunday, nor in any new elections. Here in Kosovo, which is technically still part of the former Yugoslavia, Kosovar Albanians hope Milosevic prevails because as long as he is in power, the West will continue to support the UN presence and Kosovo's split from Belgrade. They believe opposition leader Vojislav Koštunica is just as much a nationalist as Milosevic, but should he win, Kosovar Albanians fear the West will push Kosovo to begin reconciliation talks. Anne Garrels, NPR News, Pristina, Kosovo.
The stock market managed a modest rally today. The high-tech sector moved back into positive territory after three straight sessions of losses. Those losses knocked about 8.5% off the value of the Nasdaq composite. The Dow Jones Industrials closed up by 64 points today to end the day at 10,784. Decliners led advancers by a margin of 5-4 in active trading of 1.1 billion shares. The Nasdaq composite was up 67 at 3523. This is NPR News. Much in recent economic numbers has pointed to a slowdown, but the Commerce Department reported today that factory orders rebounded in August. Steve Beckner of Market News International reports.
Factory orders rose $7.5 billion, or 2%, to $382.5 billion in August, led by an increase in orders for transportation equipment, largely aircraft and parts. Excluding transportation, new orders were up 1.3%. There was also a sizable gain in orders for electronic and other electrical equipment. The August increase was a bit misleading since it followed an 8.1% drop in orders in July. Still, for the first 8 months of the year, new orders are nearly 9% above the same period a year ago. It will be another month before factory orders for September are released, but preliminary indications from the National Association of Purchasing Management are that orders softened last month. For NPR News, I'm Steve Beckner.
President Clinton said today he will sign a disaster declaration for southern Florida following heavy rains. The president issued the statement as he wrapped up a two-day trip to Florida during which tropical rainstorms grounded his own plane in Miami. Flooding caused by a foot or more of rain crippled the Miami area today. Schools and businesses were closed and the water stranded thousands of motorists. Florida Power and Light Company said 65,000 customers were without electricity at one point. Ivory Coast State Television reports four people killed and seven wounded today when a bomb they were planning to plant exploded in their faces. The explosion occurred at the central bus station in the country's main city of Abidjan. Officials said the four people killed were Nigerian nationals. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When we watch a presidential debate, we hope to see the candidates think on their feet and express themselves in a reasonably spontaneous manner. But these days, the candidates and their aides leave as little to chance as possible, preparing answers to questions they expect to be asked and rehearsing their off-the-cuff quips. My guest, Alan Schroeder, has studied the history of TV presidential debates, including the behind-the-scenes preparations and controversies. He's the author of Presidential Debates, 40 Years of High-Risk TV. Schroeder is a former reporter, documentary filmmaker, and TV producer who now teaches at the School of Journalism at Northeastern University in Boston. I spoke with him early this morning and asked him first for his reaction to last night's debate between Vice President Al Gore and Texas Governor George W. Bush.
That was as close to a tie as I think I've ever seen in a presidential debate, and I'm not sure that's necessarily a compliment either.
Okay, elaborate on that.
It was a tie because neither one of them seemed to exactly leap off the screen and make his case particularly well, and that's what they were supposed to be doing. It's very interesting, this whole notion of how the debaters prepare and what they're conscious of when they go into the arena, so to speak. And both of them had worked on these specific things that, in fact, in the actual debate, they allowed to manifest once again. For instance, Gore was pretty pedantic, and that's the very thing that everybody over and over said he ought not to be. And Bush, he just seemed so eager to kind of get through his answers and move on to the next question that he did not add any depth to his image, and that was the thing that he was told he was supposed to work on. So, it shows you that sometimes all this preparation is for naught.
The debate stuck pretty closely to details on policy.
Disagreements
were over numbers. Do you think that that's what the candidates wanted, or do you think that that's the direction that the moderator, Jim Lehrer, wanted to lead them in?
I think that the substantive nature of that debate is a reflection of Jim Lehrer as a moderator, because that's what he's known for, and that is in turn a reflection on the candidates, because the candidates chose him, and presumably somewhat on the basis of their knowledge of his, sort of moderating that way. But I also think that they see some percentage in discussing the issues in front of this kind of core group of undecided voters who hold the fate of their potential presidencies in their hands. So I think that it was a substantive debate, and that was one of the good things about it. If you didn't know anything about where either man stood on the issues and tuned into this debate, I think you would have gotten some knowledge from that.
Historically, though, what really makes the biggest impact in a presidential debate? Is it the issue stuff, or is it like the big gaffes and the witty rejoinders?
Well, I think debates really serve two separate constituencies who evaluate them in two separate ways. You've got the voters as a sort of, generic block, and then you've got the media. And what the debaters are actually trying to do is play simultaneously to both those constituencies, because it isn't enough to win the audience. You also have to win the media, and those two entities are sort of self-reinforcing with each other. So in terms of winning the media part of it, the stylistics do tend to predominate. In terms of winning the voting block, it's more of a combination of the substance and the style, because the substance is less familiar to a lot of the people watching it, whereas to the media, it's not only familiar, it's overly familiar and therefore deadly dull.
The only attempt that I can recall of a, you know, of a witty rejoinder last night was when George W. Bush said, in quarreling with some of Al Gore's figures, I'm beginning to think not only did he invent the internet, he invented the calculator. It's fuzzy math. Do you think that attempt at a witty rejoinder worked?
It worked in the sense that those were the sound bites that were played on television this morning in the wake of the debate. So clearly they do devise these moments, understanding that what will happen in the media recounting of the story is that, that a sort of abbreviated, compressed narrative of the event will take place, and that's propelled by these little sound bites. So absolutely, I think when Bush gets off lines like that, that's that was his strategy, and in that sense it worked.
Did it sound prescripted to you?
Absolutely. You could just, you know, sort of all but see the puppet strings moving above his head as he's saying things like that, just as with Al Gore, that constant repetition about tax cuts for the wealthiest 1%. You know, he may as well have you know, sort of crawled it in lettering at the bottom of the screen the way they do the stock market updates, because it was so robotic.
In like the history of presidential debates, have most of the now famous witty rejoinders been scripted as well? For instance, you're no Kennedy, and there you go again.
Almost all of the famous debate rejoinders in history have been pre-scripted, despite claims to the contrary. And it does show you the value of preparation in a way that, you know, if you can go in there with that sort of landmine that you're supposed to detonate at a certain point, and then you're able to do that, that it pays off in the sound bites that you reap. So, yeah, you think about You're No Jack Kennedy, which seemed like, you know, such a heartfelt kind of plaintive rejoinder. Joined her by Lloyd Benson, and
do the whole thing for us for people who don't remember that rejoinder.
Absolutely. The rejoinder was followed Quayle's self-comparison to Jack Kennedy. He was making the point that he had a similar level of congressional experience at the time at his age compared to Jack Kennedy when he ran for the presidency in 1960. And Lloyd Benson says, Senator, I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy. And it plays out on camera in this sort of series of close-ups and two shots that just devastates Quayle. And Quayle had actually used that comparison to Jack Kennedy in speeches on the campaign trail. Benson had opposition research operatives in the audience for some of those events, so they had an inkling that it might be coming. And although Quayle himself was warned not to do it in the debate, he did, allowing Lloyd Benson this golden opportunity to just, you know, sock him one in the jaw. So absolutely, Reagan's lines, there you go again, or the joke about I won't exploit my opponent's youth and inexperience, these things clearly were devised ahead of time. So it's the fact that the lines are devised, but also how well the debater is able to make it seem otherwise. And in both instances, Lloyd Benson and Ronald Reagan, the performance was what really carried it.
For the most part in last night's debate, both candidates seemed to stick to their script. And I'm wondering if you think the questions did anything to force the candidates to really think on their feet, to force them off pre-scripted messages.
Well, Al Gore was asked this morning if he had been thrown any loops, if there were any questions he hadn't anticipated, and his answer was no, we did sort of know everything that was coming. So I would say apparently not. But I would also make the point that it isn't just the questions as posed by the moderator. The format itself was quite constricting and put the whole debate in sort of a straitjacket, in the sense that you had this fairly rigid structure, you had time limits, you had a kind of ping pong sequencing of answers and questions. And that, of course, is by the candidate's design. They're the ones who make the call on what the format is going to be. But it was interesting to me to hear both of them kind of violate that format that they had designed by wanting to press forward in following a line of argument. And that shows you how kind of random these decisions about format are. You know, here they devise the rules, and it turns out that those rules were not the best thing for either one of them.
Well, Jim Lehrer didn't stick strictly to the format. He gave the candidates some latitude to go on longer than they thought, to talk to each other in ways that were supposed to not happen.
Yes, Jim Lehrer did give them some latitude, but he pointed out on the air, as well he should, look, you're the ones who set the rules, and if you're comfortable violating them, that's what we're going to do. But I guess my point is, why don't they just go in and say, let's not have any rules? We know this guy is a capable interviewer. He proves himself on television every night. Let's just let him ask us some questions. And I think, by the way, that is closer to the format that we will see in the second debate, the one next week in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, where the two candidates are seated at a table with Lehrer and the time restrictions don't exist.
Is there any precedent for that kind of presidential debate, the two candidates
No.
and the moderator sitting around a table?
No, there is not. And that, I think, is what makes it so interesting, because what happens is, once a new format is introduced into presidential debates, it doesn't take the candidates and the campaigns very long to figure out their way around it. Let me give you an example. The town hall format was first used in 92. In 96, it was a little more restrictive. And this year, it'll be the third debate, but there's a difference this year in that the questioners must write down their questions in advance, submit them to Jim Lehrer, who then asks them, thus minimizing any potential volatility or even spontaneity on the part of the people in the audience. That's something the campaigns insisted on, and it shows that the longer a format is around, the more easily they are able to maneuver through that and work it to their advantage.
Why do you think that they're trying that new format of the two candidates and the moderator sitting around the table together?
Well, the sponsors, the debate commission, have been pressing for that for a long time. There are a lot of people who have studied debates who feel that that is sort of the gold standard of potential formats, because it is much more natural and it does lend itself more to giving insight into the minds of the candidates rather than just testing their ability to spit back funny lines and you know, sort of scripted messages. So it has been on the table for a long time as a possibility. Why the candidates agreed to it this year? I think George Bush particularly liked that format, and in fact, when he offered that counterproposal of debates at the beginning of September, that was the format he wanted for everything. And Al Gore also has done extraordinarily well in that format. So once again, it's about, do the candidates think that it's in their self-interest to adhere to something new? And in this case, they did.
Do you know if in the next presidential format where they're sitting around the table, if there are going to be time restrictions on the length of answers?
My understanding is that there are not, and that will give Jim Lehrer a much freer rein to follow particular lines of questioning, and also it opens up the possibility for the candidates to question each other, which they were not able to do last night. They had to kind of, you know, send everything back to Lehrer as a conduit. So that's going to be, I think, very interesting to see how they engage one another. Because, you know, this whole thing about what works in a debate, what doesn't work, it isn't just the individual performance of a debater, it's that performance in relation to the other debater and sort of who seizes control and who's the star and who's the co-star. So we'll see what happens, but I have high hopes for that new format.
Did you watch the debate last night on TV?
I did.
How did you choose which network to watch it on? Did you think it made a difference one way or another?
That's a very good question. I, like I suspect a lot of people in America, sat there with my remote commander at the ready and was flipping around purposely to compare how different networks were doing it. And I did see a lot of variety. It used to be that there would just be one version of the production pool fed to all the networks, and they carried that. But what's happening now is they actually send out what they call isocams, the individual shots of the candidates, as well as a master shot, and that allows each network to sort of cut its own version of the debate. So there actually was quite a bit of variety, and that's something that drives the campaigns crazy. They don't like that. They like the idea that they can control that image rather than leaving that in the hands of the networks. So I see that in some small way as a victory over the handlers, because at least you have the potential for some variety. So my network of preference is actually C-SPAN. That's what I watch right before the debate, because I like that notion of kind of the natural sound, and I like seeing the wives come out ahead of time and Jim Lehrer's admonitions to the audience. I think all of that is pretty fascinating. But once I'm in the debate, I flip around to see how the different networks are actually cutting it.
My guest is Alan Schroeder, author of Presidential Debates, 40 Years of High-Risk TV. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. ¶¶ If you're just joining us, my guest is Alan Schroeder and is the author of the new book, Presidential Debates, 40 Years of High-Risk TV. In your book, Presidential Debates, you write that the solo moderator and the town hall forum have revolutionized the nature of presidential debates. Last night we saw an example of the solo moderator approach. What's revolutionary about that? Why is that so important?
Well, what was revolutionary about it when they were first introduced, and of course the longer something is extant, the less revolutionary it is, so we're kind of at that point here in 2000. But in 92, when those things were first introduced, they broke a hold on format of the press panel that had been in effect since 1960. And again, that's because the candidates themselves took comfort in knowing that it was, you know, the same old format of four reporters at a desk and a moderator and boom, 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 down the line, ask your question and let's get on to something else. And so for the longest time, the candidates resisted any innovation in format. So in 92, when the town hall format was introduced, and by the way, we can thank Bill Clinton for that. That was his idea. And the single moderator as well. That broke this pattern of institutionalization of the debate formats that made it revolutionary. And as you rightly suggest, there wasn't anything terribly revolutionary about last night's debate. So, you know, maybe it's time to think of some new format things.
Jim Lehrer's questions stuck, you know, mostly to the big issues. Some of the most famous questions historically are questions that were really odd in their own way, like Bernard Shore's question to Dukakis that if his wife Kitty had been raped and murdered, would he want to see the perpetrator executed? And it was, you know, basically an anecdotal approach to the death penalty question. Now, is that considered to have been a very good or just a very strange question? Have you talked to a lot of journalists about and a lot of presidential aides about what they think of that question?
Well, you know what's interesting about that is on Thursday night in the vice presidential debate this year, the moderator is going to be none other than Bernard Shaw. And the moderator is chosen by the campaigns. So I think that they're granting him their seal of approval shows you that the campaigns aren't too worried about him asking another bizarre question like that. At the time, the reaction ran sort of all across the spectrum. But as the years go on, I think people are more and more sort of put off by that question. Kitty herself was quite unhappy with it, as one might imagine. And the three other panelists in that debate in 1988 were all happened to be women, and they actually tried to talk Bernard Shaw out of asking it that way. They said, you know, look, ask it in a generic way. Don't say the words Kitty Dukakis. Don't personalize it. And he felt that there was something to be gained, some insight into Michael Dukakis to be gained by personalizing it, and so he chose to do that. But I think, you know, everybody sort of had this moment of, you know, ew, what was that when he asked that question?
What are some of the other most famous questions that have been asked?
Well, there are a lot of kind of these zinger questions, and I don't know that they're necessarily the most famous, but one of my favorites was in 1984 when Fred Barnes asked Ronald Reagan, you know, he said something like, you call yourself a born-again Christian, you consider yourself a religious man, so why is it that you don't go to church? And it seems like such a, you know, kind of almost a nasty thing, but it does show you that sometimes debates are about pointing out that the emperor has no clothes, and we don't get too many chances in our civic life to do that. So the debates fill an important role in that regard. Let's see. There's been this trend toward, and I think the first example of this one was in the Benson Quayle debate, this trend toward asking people what their favorite book, film, you know, work of art kind of thing is. And that's almost run its course because, of course, now they're prepared with these very suspicious answers, these suspiciously convenient answers that kind of pump up their intellectual prowess. In the first town hall debate in history in Richmond, Virginia in 1992, where you had Bush, Clinton, and Perot as the candidates, the people in that audience asked some of the most interesting questions and the most non-journalistic questions. Things like, why do you spend so much time trashing each other's character when what we really want you to do is the job of presidency? And sort of force them to respond to something that people had been feeling viscerally for a long time, but that fell outside the kind of accepted boundaries of journalistic interrogation. And so, you know, I think that there is some value in having different people ask questions. And frankly, I admire Jim Lehrer a lot, and I think he's a terrific interviewer, but I would like to have seen this year different moderators for each of the debates on the theory that you get new information from different questioners, not to mention different formats, and that the more variety there is, the more educational and informative the debates have the potential to be.
When there were panels of journalists questioning the candidates, did the panelists usually coordinate their questions so those two people didn't ask the same thing, didn't come prepared with the same question?
Some panelists did collaborate, and others studiously avoided it. And it was kind of interesting in going back over the years and talking to panelists to kind of pick up on the wide variety of arrangements that existed on panels. There were a couple of panels that at one point debated the possibility of throwing the candidates for a total loop and just saying, look, we don't like this format. Why don't you guys just talk to each other? And doing that on live television. And, of course, that never actually happened, but wouldn't it have been fascinating if it had? The panel in the 1988 Benson Quayle debate, one of the reasons that Dan Quayle backed himself into that corner in comparing himself to John F. Kennedy was that the panelists had agreed that if they did not get a satisfactory answer, that they would follow up on each other's questions until it was answered in a satisfactory way. And so Quayle was actually asked several times by several different panelists, why are you qualified to ascend to the presidency should you be required to do that? And that's how he got into that kind of contortion of comparing himself to John F. Kennedy. So I think that some of the best debates are a reflection of a team effort by the panelists, and probably that's one reason that the candidates have begun to shy away from that format. They know the journalists are capable of behaving that way.
Alan Schroeder is the author of Presidential Debates, 40 Years of High-Risk TV. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Vintage Books Division, paperback publishers of Plainsong, the new novel by Kent Haraf. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, lighting, makeup, hair, and camera angles. We continue our conversation with Alan Schroeder about last night's Gore-Bush showdown and the history of TV presidential debates. And Kevin Whitehead reviews the new CD from Branford Marsalis, which we're listening to now. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our conversation about last night's face-off between Al Gore and George W. Bush and how it fits into the history of TV presidential debates. My guest, Alan Schroeder, is the author of the new book, Presidential Debates, 40 Years of High-Risk TV. He's a former reporter, documentary filmmaker, and TV producer who now teaches in the School of Journalism at Northeastern University in Boston. We've been talking a lot about, you know, content and format, but let's face it, one of the really important things about a TV debate is how the candidates look. And, you know, lighting and makeup are two really important things, and everybody learned that lesson back in 1960 with the Kennedy-Nixon debates. What did you think of the lighting last night and the
makeup?
Well,
I'm glad you asked that question, because I was sort of struck by a couple of strange things just in the basic shots of the candidates. One was that that Al Gore, his makeup job sort of reminded me, you know, they used to have those little ventriloquist dolls called Jerry Mahoney, where he was this little puppet who had real rosy cheeks. I kind of had that image in my head of Al Gore. He looked almost doll-like, his lighting and his facial makeup and that sort of thing. The other thing that struck me visually, looking at the contrast of the two candidates, was how much more imposing Gore seemed. Just physically, he seemed to fill the frame a little more than Bush did. And when they would cut over to Bush, he seemed sort of slight, and he just didn't occupy the space as presumptively as Gore did. And that's not a lighting trick. I don't know exactly what that is, but it happened before with Reagan and Carter. You know, Reagan was this sort of well-built, broad-shouldered guy, and Carter was this much slighter figure. And when they would cut back and forth to the two of them, you became aware of that physical difference. And I suppose it's dangerous to over-conclude from that, but there is some kind of message being sent there.
This was probably just my imagination, but I thought that the lighting changed a few minutes into the debate last night. I thought that early on Al Gore's complexion looked very sallow, and that Bush's complexion looked really quite rosy, and that the lighting changed a little bit a little further in, and Gore looked less sallow. That is probably completely my imagination. It probably didn't happen at all, but...
It may have been an optical illusion. I can't imagine. Once the thing is in progress, they're not going to start changing much of anything.
Well, that was my question. Are there, like, aides behind the scenes who are saying, no, you blew it on the lighting. You've got to turn up the light or turn down the light or refocus the light?
In years past, and this is all negotiated, this is all in a written contract, the campaigns have been allowed to have a representative in the control room during the live production of the debate, much to the dismay of the director who's sitting in there trying to do his job. But in practice, they haven't really posed too many demands. I mean, for one thing, look, the train is headed down the tracks, and once the locomotive has left the station, there's not a heck of a lot you can do about it. Really, the year where that was true, where you had campaign aides in the control room literally yelling at each other and at the director, was in 1960 in the first debate, and it had to do with the cutaway shots of Nixon when he wasn't speaking, and you would see him mopping his brow and sort of his eyes darting around in kind of strange directions. And Kennedy's man in the control booth was saying, let's get more reaction shots of Nixon. Let's get more reaction shots of Nixon, because it was to their advantage. And Nixon's people were saying, no, quit taking that shot. But in more recent times, they're allowed to have a representative in the control room, but not much arguing goes on. And how could it? You know, somebody has a job to do. You're live. You can't possibly negotiate something while it's happening in front of 70 million people.
Well, you write that in the Reagan-Mondale debate, Michael Deaver, one of Reagan's aides, wanted Reagan lit differently than he had been lit, and that had a bad effect on how Mondale ended up looking.
That's right. And as a result of that...
Well, tell us the story.
Yes. What happened was there were two debates in 1984, and in the first one, Reagan's lighting was not terribly good, and it did not favor him, and Reagan looked bad for a number of reasons in that debate, but lighting was one of them. So when they go to Kansas City for the second debate of 1984, Michael Deaver, Reagan's aide, makes certain that the lighting is changed, and he actually lit Reagan from above to kind of cast this line across his shoulders, and in a way that absolutely favored Reagan and absolutely made Mondale Avondale look funereal. And that lighting change was made after the Mondale people had left the hall, and apparently against their wishes and in violation of some of the pre-negotiated rules. And in years since then, the candidates have made absolute certain to not allow that to happen again. And so lighting, once it's set, does not change.
Both candidates last night wore dark suits and red ties. They were very closely dressed. Is there any common wisdom about that outfit, the dark suit, the red tie? I guess nobody's going to come in wearing a red sharkskin suit to the presidential debate, but...
No. I think from a fashion standpoint, the debates are sort of the anti-Academy Awards. It's not dressed to bring attention to yourself. It's dressed to not have Joan Rivers make any comments about you afterwards whatsoever. Yeah, wasn't that curious? It does show you that the campaigns are operating in isolation in advance of the debate. And one wonders, you know, what were they thinking when they walked out there and noticed each what the other was wearing? You know, red, white, and blue, you've got the kind of patriotic thing. It worked with the set. You've got that sort of power tie thing going. It's funny, I was watching some of the post-debate commentary, and one of the interviewees was Dick Cheney, who had on that same identical outfit as well. Only Joe Lieberman of the four of them demonstrated any sort of sartorial originality.
And there was a blue backdrop behind the candidates, a very TV blue. You say that in the Ford and Carter debate, their aides battled over the shade of blue for the backdrop. Was that an issue
they
in
did.
Last night's debate, do you think?
No, the blue background is designed, obviously, to be as generic as it can possibly be. And yes, it does. It almost looks like one of those blue chroma key screens
exactly.
that the TV weatherman
exactly.
stands
yeah.
in front. You expected Al Gore to start, you know, pointing to the high-pressure area over El Paso. But I think they want as minimalist a background as possible so that people will pay attention to them and not the background. In 1976, the blueness of the background had to do with Gerald Ford's thinning hair. The Ford aides thought that Gerald Ford's hair looked even thinner against a certain shade of blue and therefore wanted something that they thought would take care of that. I would say after height, hair is probably the number two issue in pre-negotiating presidential debates.
Hair?
Well, yeah, because, you know, who's not paranoid about hair when you go on television? And I'm thinking of George Bush. He needed to stand on a certain side of the stage because of the side of his head that his part was on, and he sort of felt that the hairline was appearing to recede too much if he was on a certain half of the stage as opposed to the other.
My guest is Alan Schroeder, author of Presidential Debates, 40 Years of High-Risk TV. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Alan Schroeder, author of the new book, Presidential Debates, 40 Years of High-Risk TV. Now, no third-party candidates were invited to the debate last night. Ralph Nader managed to get a ticket to the debate, but he was barred from the door by a member of the Commission on Presidential Debates. And that person said, it's already been decided that whether or not you have a ticket, you are not welcome in the debate. Is there any precedent for that?
No, I don't think there is. Usually they just file their lawsuits. They don't physically show up and try to crash the debate. And wouldn't that have been fascinating had he somehow gotten into the debate hall? You know, these moments that never were. No, I can't think of an instance in which someone who has been excluded from the debates tried to insinuate himself physically. There was an interesting thing in 1980. John Anderson was the third-party candidate that year, the independent candidate that year. And he was not invited invited to join the Carter-Reagan debate. So what CNN did was actually set up this program by which they electronically inserted his answers to the live debate as it was unfolding in Cleveland. But what happened was they got the tapes all mixed up, and so Anderson would be answering a question that hadn't actually been asked yet in the other debate, and it became this this kind of very bizarre, you know, inadvertently postmodern version of a presidential debate.
What are the commission's rules for deciding which third-party candidates should be allowed to participate in the presidential debates?
This year, the main criterion for inclusion of third-party and independent candidates was a 15% standing in the public opinion polls. And the sponsoring commission is very cautious about this question because they lay themselves open to lawsuits, and so they're trying to devise some means that is legal and that they can win on in court on, because they are inevitably taken to court on these things. Frankly, 15% seems high to me, and I don't know that this was necessarily the year that either Nader or Buchanan ought to have been included, but I'm a little uneasy with 15% and wonder if there might be a more inclusive way of doing this.
Who's on the commission?
The commission was started by the two parties in 1988. It became a nonpartisan commission a few years later, and it has members, different civic leaders, and academics, and I believe Caroline Kennedy Schlossberg is on the board, the former head of the League of Women Voters. So it has a membership across the spectrum, but what makes a lot of people uneasy about the commission is its history as a bipartisan organization chaired by the two former chairs of the Democratic and Republican parties.
Bipartisan in the sense that it's the two major parties and there aren't any third-party representatives, so the commission is seen as representing the major parties and therefore more likely to eliminate the third-party candidates.
Yes, that's right. And the only time that a third-party candidate has been allowed to participate was in 1992. You had both Ross Perot and Admiral Stockdale participating in that year's debates, and appropriately so. I'm really torn on this question because I think that we have so few opportunities to evaluate the people who are likely to get voted that to, you know, kind of dilute that with additional people in the debate might not be such a great idea. And I'm thinking during the primary debates, George W. Bush was always surrounded by a lot of other candidates until the very end, but he never did a one-on-one with John McCain. And I think voters were deprived of something by not having that. So maybe the answer is to start the debate season a little earlier, do more debates, kind of begin with everybody and winnow the field as it goes along. It's a question that obviously is going to have to be revisited and probably will be every 4 years.
How influential, finally, are presidential debates?
They actually have been influential, maybe not even so much at the ballot box, but they've been influential as civic institutions, and they've definitely been influential as history and as historical comments on particular candidates. John F. Kennedy thought that television in general, he didn't say debates, but he said we wouldn't have had a prayer without that gadget, referring to television, and really credited the medium with his election. But as far as a direct attribution or a direct cause and effect link between a particular debate and someone's election, I don't think we can make that. But I do think that debates sort of leave an imprint on the candidate, and particularly for candidates who want to run for office in the future. The Dan Quayle example, again, serves us well here, because that whole "you're no Jack Kennedy" thing, you know, that just hung over his head, along with the potato misspelling and all of these other little silly things, in such a way that made him less credible as a candidate down the line. So they do have repercussions for the participants that the participants have to live with for a long time.
You mentioned Kale's performance as a vice presidential candidate. The next debate is the vice presidential debate on Thursday. Tell us what you're expecting with that, you know, format-wise, and what you're going to be looking for.
Well, that actually is the introduction of this format of the moderator and the candidates sitting around a table. And it's interesting that the vice presidential people are doing it a few days before the presidentials. My guess is the reason that it was negotiated and structured that way is to give Gore and Bush a chance to kind of hone their preparations and get an idea of what to expect from that format. In effect, Lieberman and Cheney are being used as guinea pigs for this format. But having said that, I actually have high hopes for it. Vice presidential debates often are more animated and interesting than the presidential debates because there's a little less at stake. They're kind of more relaxed, and often they get a little more negative because the job of the vice presidential candidate traditionally is to go on the attack against the top of the ticket on the opposition, and it's much easier for Joe Lieberman to criticize George Bush in absentia than it was for Gore to go after him when he's just standing there a few feet away, and such a thing would look unseemly. So with the presidential candidates absent, the vice presidential candidates are almost liberated to lodge their slings and arrows a little more readily.
Television has broadcast presidential debates over the course of 40 years. How do you think our expectations of presidential speaking style in these debates have changed? You know, what we expect of the candidates, both in terms of the language they use, what we expect of the charisma that they exude.
Oh, I think a great deal has changed on that count, and in fact, you know, what we're looking at is a whole different level of communication from the 1960 era, even in such a relatively short time. The expectations of how presidents talk to the country have changed. This thing last night, for instance, of each of the two men citing individual Americans by name and telling their stories, it's this emphasis on the kind of personal narrative. Kennedy and Nixon would never have done that. That's a reflection of our own times and the more empathetic sort of touchy-feely culture that we live in. I think also that Bill Clinton changed this whole notion of presidential debating for everyone. And one of the reasons I personally felt let down last night, I can't help but think, is that, you know, there's a new standard to meet, and Clinton was the best debater in history, and neither of these guys came close to him, either on stylistics or just in being able to articulate their positions. So I think that we expect more from our candidates. We expect a higher level of telegenic quality. You know, you're looking at these candidates and you're thinking, I got to live with this person on the newscast for the next 4 years, and please don't bore me to death before I've even voted for you. Richard Nixon himself said that the only thing that you weren't allowed to be in politics was dull, and dullness is the enemy of television, just as it's the enemy of politics. So they must perform at a higher level than they used to have to.
Why did you want to write a book on presidential debates?
I spent a lot of time producing live television at local stations around the country, and I saw some of the things that could go wrong on live TV. I once had a guest die on me 5 minutes before air. That was actually my very first job in television, and I decided nothing would ever frighten me in my entire life again. And I had a riot break out one time on live television in a studio audience, and it just got me thinking how utterly unpredictable live TV in general is, and how at odds that is with the whole notion of how people campaign for presidency, which is to just coat themselves in as many layers of protection as they possibly can. So I was always interested in politics, and I've always had this kind of fascination with live TV and its pitfalls and its perils. And so I put those together and started in 1988 really studying this thing and thinking hard about it. And I think I chose the right topic because I'm still not bored with it after all these years and all this babbling about it. It still has the capacity to fascinate me. Although if we see a lot more debates like last night's, that could change.
Alan Schroeder, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Alan Schroeder is the author of Presidential Debates, 40 Years of High-Risk TV. He teaches in the School of Journalism at Northeastern University in Boston. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews Branford Marsalis's new CD. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Saxophonist Branford Marsalis made a name for himself in the early 1980s as a member of his younger brother Winton's quintet. A few years later, he started his own bands. In the early 90s, Branford was Jay Leno's first band leader on The Tonight Show, and then started making jazz hip-hop records with his group Buckshot LaFunk. He's also made a lot of acoustic jazz albums. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says the saxophonist was never in a hurry to develop his own style, but in the last few years, he's arrived.
Branford Marsalis' new album is called Contemporary Jazz. That title is the only blah thing about it. For the most part, it's exactly what straight-ahead jazz should be, tough and inventive, with a pulse. Branford's quartet makes real group music. It's not about a soloist fronting a rhythm section, but everybody working together to push the music ahead. The opener, In the Crease, is a tricky pile-up of fast-changing time signatures. But the great drummer Jeff Watts in particular makes the algebra sound like spontaneous accents, not stunt work. The rest of Marsalis' quartet is stealthy bassist Eric Rivas and pianist Joey Caldarazzo, who's a bit too fond of old McCoy Tyner and Herbie Hancock routines. Most of the tunes on the new CD are by members of the band, but its centerpiece is a comb-over of Irving Berlin's Cheek to Cheek. Marsalis restyles the melody from the opening bar, a cheeky strategy. You're gonna rewrite Irving Berlin? But he gets away with it, maybe because he sounds so eager to twist the tune to his own ends. A lot of highly touted young jazz musicians have come and gone in the two decades Branford Marsalis has been around. He just turned 40. For a long time, he was content to impersonate his saxophone heroes, all of whom are more readily identifiable than he is. But the voice he has evolved on tenor saxophone really suits him, and he can do a lot with it. Mostly, he improvises like the quick and quick-witted person he is. On his new album, Marsalis spends so much time playing at fast tempos, he wears some folks out. But it's not all he does. ¶¶ that blues, it's called Sleepy Hollow, appears unbilled on Branford Marsalis' new CD, tucked away after the official ending, a little surprise which I have now spoiled. Sneaking it in like that is typical of the artist. Just when you think you've seen all his cards, he pulls out another ace.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of New Dutch Swing. He reviewed Contemporary Jazz, the new CD by saxophonist Branford Marsalis. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, and Roberta Shurrock, with Megan Howell and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Tariq Rose. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Princeton University Press, publishers of The Expanded Quotable Einstein, available in bookstores or online at www.pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, Rack, that samples Otis Redding, Liberace, George Clinton, and Schoolhouse Rock. We talk with two members of De La Soul about their more than 10 years in hip-hop and their new CD. I'm Tariq Rose. Join us for the next Fresh Air. Is it just my De La Soul?